new book out called The Word, and the subtitle is The History of the Bible and How It Came to Us. This is by historian Rod Gragg. We've had him on Vocal Point before, and it's a privilege to have him on again. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and Rod, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Jerry. Good to be here.
All right. Well, first of all, tell us about this book, which is really about the history of the Bible.
Well, it is. It surveys the history of the Bible from the age of antiquity, the development of writing in the Mideast, papyrus, cuneiform parchment, to the establishment of the Old and New Testament, background on the Bible's languages, the original languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, and why that made a difference. Standards of canonization, the spread of the gospel, survival of the Bible through the ages of persecution, influence of the Gutenberg movable type press, the Reformation, and then the very dramatic story of the English language Bible, and it ends up with the impact of the Bible on America.
All right. Well, first of all, some people would say, well, which Bible? And here I think they mean, well, talk about those, the Apocrypha, the books of the Apocrypha that are not found in all the Bibles.
The book explains and deals with that and explains the history of the Apocrypha and when it was used and why it's not used and why it's not used today or it's not accepted today as canonical scripture by the Jewish people or by most Protestants.
But it is important to point out, too, that there's no major doctrines brought out in the Apocrypha that make any kind of earth-shattering difference, so either way. Plus, I will say this, the Maccabees, 1st and 2nd Maccabees in the Apocrypha, add some interesting and very important historical information during the intertestamental period. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, right. There's a great deal of cultural value in the books of the Apocrypha and insights into the time periods, but has not been continued throughout. There's always been a cloud around it, in a sense that in its comparison to Scripture, it was used for much of the history of the Bible, and from the early church onward, but always with a caveat. There was a question about it being comparable or being canonized, being truly scriptural. And Martin Luther put it in his German translation. It was in the King James Bible when it was first translated, and it's continued in use today. But the Jewish people have never accepted it. Jewish scholars on par with Scripture, and the Protestant denominations, churches, Protestants in general, look at it only for its cultural value and do not consider it to be on par with Scripture or to be canonical.
All right. Now, you had mentioned earlier that the Bible was written in Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek. Now, the Aramaic, there I can think of a few sentences from Jesus quoted in the Gospels which were written in Greek, you know, like Tabitha cum, or, you know, a few words here and there, a few phrases. But are there actual books that were composed in Aramaic, the language that Jesus spoke?
No, not at all. It says,
okay, so that's what you're referring to.
It's usage there that you see as colloquial expressions. There are a few in the Old Testament. There are the notable ones in the New Testament that you mentioned, but the principal languages of the Bible are, of course, Hebrew and Greek.
Okay, so Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's one of the classic examples of Aramaic that we find. Okay.
That's right, and Aramaic was important as far as the Bible is concerned, because you see the kind of the decline and then the rise again of the use of Hebrew. And at the time, Aramaic became the language of the street, and Hebrew became the language of the scriptures. And then with the rise of Greek as a universal language, it came to replace the Aramaic and also, again, kind of challenge the Hebrew as far as the Old Testament is concerned. But the Hebrew, of course, has resurfaced and did so through the ages and also now. And the remarkable thing about the languages, they each have a role in that you see the quotations you made of the Aramaic, which is used very lightly within the scriptures, but it gives us the flavor and the understanding of the language that was spoken at the time of Christ. And it's also a reminder of that language being spread throughout the Mideast by conquest. And then the Hebrew, of course, is amazing language and the language of the Old Testament. It is a very vivid language. It is a language that, because it's so vivid and it's so memorable that it would be used for memorization. And then we see Greek, and the remarkable thing about the Greek is that in the 4th century, Alexander the Great conquered the Mediterranean basin and then went on as far as India. Some say went on as far as the Pacific. And he spread Greek language wherever he went. And so by the time of the 1st century and the Gospels mm-hmm. were being taken throughout the civilized world, the Mediterranean world, the Western world, and the Mideast, and even as far as India, early on, when all of that happened, you had the Greek language, and you had this remarkable system of Roman roads over much of that. So it's like a perfect storm in the sense that you had this communications media, like a mass media, the universal language of Greek that could be used for sharing the gospel, and then you had this mass transportation system, so to speak, these Roman roads
right.
used to propel it. And so you stand back and look at that as a Christian historian, and you know, the historian, this is what happened. As a Christian, you have to think that was providential.
Oh, absolutely. And on top of that, add the network of synagogues that were all over the Roman world, by which Paul and the early missionaries first went to the synagogues to bring the gospel to the Jew first and then the Gentile. And you have the explosion of Christianity in the first century A.D. That's just fantastic. What a great story. Okay, you have written a lot of books about history. I've talked with you in the past about the pilgrims, about Christians who bravely risked their lives to shelter Jews during the evil days of the Nazis. You've written, that one's called My Brother's Keeper. You've written about Gettysburg. And these are really nice books, award-winning books. What caused you to write about the Bible?
Well, thank you for those kind words.
Sure.
I would say, before being a historian, I'm a Christian. And so I have a deep respect and love for the Bible. And as a historian, I always want to know the backstory, so to speak.
Yeah.
I'm sure you feel the same way with the work you've done. And so it was my hope for a long time to write a history of the Bible. And that's what I've tried to do. It is it's not a work of apologetics, although it does explain a lot. And there are apologetics in there. It's not a Bible commentary, but I hope that it's useful when people study the Bible. And that's not a work of theology, but of course there's theology in there. It's a history of the Bible itself. It's not a history of the events in the Bible, but a history of the book of books itself. And as you know, it's a fascinating history.
When we think about what a treasure it is to have the Bible in our own language, and we're spoiled by an embarrassment of riches of having different translations, and they all provide something, in the mix, in the overall thing of, but to have the Bible in our own language is an amazing privilege, and we should be grateful to God every day, basically, for John Wycliffe, for William Tyndale, him especially, above all, Miles Coverdale, John Rogers. Tell us about those four men, and why should we be grateful as Christians for them? And you talk a lot about them in your book.
Well, that's right, and you're talking there about the development of the English language Bible, and you think about John Wycliffe, who was pretty much first, and he was a Catholic clergyman and instructor at Oxford University in England in the late 14th century. He was elderly near the end of his days when he translated the Bible into English, and they called it Middle English then, and Early English. He believed that everyone should have access to the Bible. So this was the first English translation did it by hand, had to be hand-printed because the Gutenberg movable type press was still far away from its invention. And even so, it was very costly to do a hand-printed Bible, and yet there was a demand for it. And the tradition is that if you could find a Wycliffe Bible, you could borrow it for a wagon load of hay.
Wow.
And people were just eager for the scriptures in their own languages, but church authorities didn't share that view. And 40 years
Why is that? Yeah, okay, 40 years after they even dug up his remains and then desecrated his remains to punish him, but of course he was long dead. But why is that? Why the pushback on the part of the official church against getting the Bible into one's own language?
Well, the general reason that you see there and through the era of the Reformation was church officials said that they thought that the common people could not properly understand the Bible on their own without assistance and interpretation by clergy, and they felt like it would be dangerous in their hands. They said that at times. And they also believed that they had the role of protecting the scriptures and preserving their integrity, and their argument was that they felt like if it was placed in everyday languages, it would become too common. And they also they felt like that it ought to be under the control of the church hierarchy, not in the hands of the common people. And when it did, of course, when it did get into the hands of the common people, just speaking about the English Bible, the result was phenomenal in English-speaking regions, nations, and among peoples. Eventually, when a Bible was authorized, say the Great Bible was a pulpit Bible that was finally authorized by the English monarchy in the latter part of King Henry VIII's reign, it was posted and chained to pulpits, and the clergy complained that they could not have services because the people were crowding into the churches on Sunday mornings and crowding around the Bible and each wanting to take a look at it, to touch it, to ask someone to read it to them in English. And the great English 20th century or late 19th century, early 20th century historian John Richard Green said that, in his words, the Bible transformed the nation. In his words, the whole nation became a church. And that really affects us Americans and the points made in this book in the sense that the English Bible really did transform England, and it brought that the strength to that Judeo-Christian worldview, and it produced what became known as the English Reformation, and where there was just great zeal and knowledge among the common people of Scripture. And in the wake of that era and that atmosphere, America was colonized, and all these English people spilled into these 13 colonies, bringing their core values with them, which was the Judeo-Christian worldview or the biblical perspective, and that, of course, became the foundation of the culture, laws, and government of the United States.
Yeah, in fact, one of your earlier books is Forged in Faith, which documents all these details. You have a picture of John Adams, our second president, one of the key founding fathers. He's the one who suggested that George Washington become our commander-in-chief, just propelling him on the national stage, the father of our country. Why do you have a picture of John Adams in your book? And we're almost out of time, by the way.
Well, there's a chapter in the book about the impact of the Bible in the formation of colonial America and in the United States, and then how the Bible developed in America as... And if you look at the colonial era, and if you look at the formation of America, and you look at our founding documents, and the Declaration of Independence is the mission statement, Constitution's the rule book. You don't see philosophy in the rule book. It's a rule book. You find the heart, the philosophy, the emotion, the meaning, the drive, the purpose in the mission statement, and the mission statement's the Declaration of Independence, and it's no accident that its preamble says that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable or God-given rights, including liberty, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, that was an expression of that biblical worldview.
Exactly. And we're basically out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us. Rod Gragg, G-R-A-G-G, the word, the history of the Bible and how it came to be, wndbooks.com for more information. Rod, thanks again for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Jerry. Always a pleasure.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye now.